Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
We can start a few minutes late here. So we have a different study this morning. As you know, we've been trying to slot in more people with opportunities to teach throughout the school year. And Jason Brzezinski asked me for an opportunity to present a lesson. And so that's what we're going to have today. So those of you that are watching online, we are live streaming this. Jason, just so you know, the mic is in this.
Okay.
So don't try not to mess with the iPad.
I won't mess with
next Sunday we'll resume the normal study. But Jason, I don't want to take up any of your time. So if you want to come on up and get started.
Sure.
Appreciate you doing the study.
Not a problem. Good morning, everybody. Let me open with a word of prayer, okay? Dear Father, I thank you for this life that you've given me and everyone in here. I thank you for your Son and what he did for us on the cross, and I thank you for the opportunity to be up here to present your word. I pray that it's edifying to those who are listening. In Jesus Christ's name, amen. I prepared a study titled, When I'm Weak, Then I Am Strong. And this is a verse in 2 Corinthians. A lot of us know it pretty well. It's the verse where Paul's got the thorn in the flesh, and he asked the Lord three times if it could be removed. And the Lord said, I'm not going to do that. My grace is good enough for you. And then Paul goes on to say, I'd rather glory in my infirmities, for when I'm weak, then I am strong. So I'm going to talk about weakness, temptation, power, and kind of how all those fit in together. But before I do that, I want to give kind of a short testimony, because this study has a lot of meaning in my life and what I've been through. That's kind of why I put it together. Most of you in here know me. My name's Jason. My wife, Jacqueline, and I don't believe Caleb, our firstborn, was born yet, but we started attending here in 2011, I think, or 12, maybe 2011, and left in 2013. I don't want to get into the details on why we left. I was thinking about it this morning driving here. Looking back on it, I know it wasn't the right reason. At the time, I thought I left for the right reasons, but looking back, I know I didn't. But I can't second guess that, because I am where I am today. I'm reminded of the verse in Romans where Paul says all things work together for the good. I mean, maybe some would disagree, but I think that includes evil and good. So sometimes we can't second guess ourselves. I had some pretty major strongholds that came to light in my life in 2018, February 2018. And so I began addressing some of these. And called up Brian somewhere around then and told him my story. And he said, you're more than welcome to come back. And so we returned in 2018 and started learning about the brain stuff, more of the practical side of the word. That practical side of the word began to slowly open up to me in my life. Slowly. It's just now beginning to open up. I feel like I've gone back and I'm like in infancy stage again, and I'm learning how to crawl, and now I need to know how to walk and so forth. During my absence from Grace Life, it was like 5 years, I was in the Word quite a bit. I mean, I was in the Word doctrinally. I knew the practical side of the Word, but I didn't experience it in my life, and I think there's a big difference there. I mean, I knew it was all over Paul's letters, but it had to take a major event in my life for me to actually realize it and sort of experience it. And I think those are two entirely different things. I'll talk about this verse, but I think in Philippians where Paul says he wanted to know the power of Christ's resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, I think that's kind of experiential in his life, not just knowing it as a simple fact. This study sort of came about. I have a pretty good friend in Montana, a brother in Christ, who asked me a question one day. He struggles with temptation and falling victim to it. And he asked me if his struggle against temptation and kind of falling to it could be considered an infirmity of the flesh. And I didn't think too long about it. I was actually driving when I was talking with him, and I said, yeah, I think your struggle could be considered an infirmity of the flesh. And he was referring to Romans 6:19, and I have it up here. It says, I speak after the manner of men because of the infirmity of your flesh, for as ye have yielded your members servants, for as ye have yielded your members servants to uncleanness and to iniquity unto iniquity, even so now yield your members servants to righteousness unto holiness. So I told him, I said, yeah, I think this could be considered an infirmity of the flesh. And he said, okay, so therefore I should take pleasure in infirmities, for when I am weak, then I am strong. And so now he's referring to 2 Corinthians, where Paul says, therefore I take pleasure in infirmities and reproaches and necessities and persecutions, for when I am weak, then I am strong. And so now I kind of had to think about this. I mean, is that the life that Christ wants us to live? If we do fall to temptation, is that considered a weakness? Is that what Paul was talking about when he said, for when I am weak, then I am strong? I mean, we will from time to time fall, and you know, our walk's not going to be worthy all the time. So I had to rethink this, and I kind of asked myself this question: does giving in to temptation really make us weak? I believe I asked Brian about it at church, about the infirmity of the flesh. Could this be considered an infirmity of the flesh? Could my struggles in my life be considered an infirmity of the flesh? And he said, I believe you said, Brian, that well, our flesh is weak. I think you said that. I think you said our flesh is weak. Not that our flesh has infirmities, but our flesh itself is weak. And so now, after having gone through the study, you know, part of me thinks it seems kind of obvious that this is the case, but then again, it really doesn't. So this study is going to be my personal thoughts on what this verse means. Go to the next slide here. So let's read 2 Corinthians 12:10 in context. And when I say context, I mean just a couple of the preceding verses. I'll start in 2 Corinthians verse 7. You're more than welcome to turn to it, but most of the verses in this study today I will have up on the slide to make it a little bit easier. So, 2 Corinthians 12, verse 7, unless I should be exalted above measure, through the abundance of the revelations there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. For this thing I besought the Lord thrice, that it might depart from me. And he said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly therefore will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Today I want to focus on this infirmities, the weakness part of it. I know that there's necessities and distresses and so forth, but I do want to focus on infirmities. So I kind of just want to go through this, pick some of this stuff out. We have a thorn in the flesh here. We know what that is. I mean, it's a messenger of Satan to buffet Paul. And buffet's a pretty serious term. I mean, that's, you know, you think of a boxing match. I mean, there's some pretty serious stuff going on there. What this messenger of Satan entailed, I mean, it's anybody's guess. They could have been sort of deceptive brain messages. They could have been accusations. They could have been temptations. I mean, Satan's referred to a lot of different things in the scriptures. He is referred to as an accuser. I think Paul refers to him as a tempter somewhere in Thessalonians. And it's also important to note, too, that Christ's strength is made perfect in our weakness, you know, in our flesh. And glorying, or in other words, kind of boasting in our weakness, because his strength is made perfect in that weakness, that in and of itself allows the power of Christ to rest upon us. And I have a note here that I believe the power of Christ resting upon us is actually different than the indwelling Holy Spirit that actually seals us until the day of redemption. I did look up rest, and Brian, you know, might know more about this than me. May rest, that Greek word is in the subjunctive mood, which I believe indicates like probability or objective possibility, meaning it's sort of conditional, it's contingent upon, if Paul's not boasting in his weakness and realizing how weak he really is, then there's a chance that the power of Christ may not rest upon him. In my opinion, I think that's what is being talked about here. And the Lord here is giving Paul strength to bear it. He's not saying that it's going to go away. I mean, Paul wanted this messenger of Satan, whatever it was that messed with him, he wanted it to go away. I mean, it was so bad where he actually had to ask him 3 different times for it to go away. So just keep in mind that he's giving Paul the ability to actually bear it, to carry it. So speaking of our flesh, our flesh is weak. I think Romans 6:19, which says, I speak after the manner of men because of the infirmity of your flesh. That word infirmity is the same Greek word translated weakness in 2 Corinthians 12:9. For my strength is made perfect in weakness. And I believe Matthew 26:41, I know in an entirely different dispensation, might sort of prove that our flesh actually is weak, because I think Christ, when they were in the Garden of Gethsemane, said, "Watch and pray that you enter not into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh itself is weak." So here, the flesh is weak against temptation. Christ says, "Don't enter into temptation, for the flesh is weak. If you enter temptation, you're going to have a tough time against it, especially if you're using the flesh to fight against it." So I have a note here. The fact of our flesh being weak, so the simple fact of our flesh being weak does not make his strength perfect, but rather we are weakened on account of our flesh being weak against temptation. And so through that struggle or through that weakness, his strength is made perfect. I've experienced this firsthand. When I was struggling with some major strongholds in my life, I wasn't truly aware of how weak I really was. I mean, I would give in to the temptations, and then I wouldn't, and then I would, and so forth. And yeah, there's this element of shame and guilt and everything as you're going through that, but I didn't really realize how weak I really was. I didn't realize the spiritual significance of that and what I was really fighting up against. So the messenger of Satan, the thorn in the flesh. I think Paul's kind of shedding more light, giving us more information, perhaps, on what that might be in Ephesians 6:12. I like to think the messenger of Satan could very well be what Paul talks about in Ephesians 6:12 here. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. I think Paul talks about the armor. I mean, as long as we are in these mortal bodies, we are absolutely going to be weak in this fight. I mean, without a doubt. If we're not putting on the armor, we have no chance. I mean, I don't know what it's like to put on the armor until a lot of my stuff was brought to the light, and now I realize what it's like to put on the armor. Can I have days where I'm not wearing my armor? Yeah, I can, and I feel like alligator bait. I mean, it's because if we don't have the armor on, we can attempt to fight against whatever we're fighting against, but we have no chance of actually, you know, winning the battle, I guess, or having small victories. The devil. He's certainly at the epicenter of all of our struggles. I have a good list here of this. This isn't all the times that Paul mentions Satan or the devil, but it's a fair amount of them. There's a verse in 2 Corinthians 10:5 that I believe has every reference to Satan, if there ever was a verse, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Now, certainly we can assume this role, you know, and every high thing that exalteth itself, we can exalt ourselves. You know, there's times where we can exalt ourselves against the knowledge of God. I think the first to do this was Satan himself, or Lucifer, I should say. In Isaiah 14, verses 12 through 14, it says, "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne." So here's the exalting right here against the knowledge of God. "I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High." Satan is referred to as the god of this world, or the god of this age. In 2 Corinthians 4:4, he's the prince and the power of the air. In Ephesians, he's the prince of this world. In John 14:30, and I believe all this has to do with what 1 John says: "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but of the world." So if all these things are of the world, lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, pride of life, and it's of the world, and Satan is the god of this world, well, so that's he's sort of a sin originated with Satan, and therefore this is why Paul has a lot to say about this. You know, first verse up there, lest Satan should get an advantage of us. 2 Corinthians 11:14, "For Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light." Satan hindered us in 1 Thessalonians. For some are already turned aside after Satan. In Ephesians, neither give place to the devil. And of course, we've got the armor here. And then there's a couple mentions about being caught in the snare of the devil. Once in 1 Timothy and another in 2 Timothy. So he's no doubt at the epicenter of many of our struggles. So, the battleground. What we're really fighting against, I believe this is where Satan wages his war in our minds. I've got a little screenshot here of a picture of a brain. This is kind of neuroplasticity 101, old pathways versus new pathways and so forth. I've got a few verses on the slide up there that talk about our mind. And I believe this is, the mind is here in our brain where our faculty of thinking takes place. Romans 12:2, "And be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." Ephesians 4:23 says, "And be renewed in the spirit of your mind." And then in Colossians 3:12, in the King James, the translation says affection, but the Revised says mind, so I use that. Could be the same thing. Set your affection or set your minds on things above, not on things that are on the earth or things that are of this world. So we definitely have a, we've got sort of this new law and this old law taking place throughout the course of our walk. Romans 7:23, Paul says, "But I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind, and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members." So, certainly the battleground takes place in our minds. I've got a video here that I want to play. Let me turn this on really quick here. I found this video. I was wondering whether I should show it or not, but there was a lot of talk in the conference about our brains and our old pathways and youth pathways and so forth. And I just thought it was fitting, at least to me in my life and what I'm going through. And it helps me realize that it can be a struggle to carve out a new pathway in our brains, to think right, to think holy, to not follow old pathways, to not continuously follow point A to point B, point A to point B. And I know that can vary to some. You know, I've traveled from point A to point B for a number of years, probably 25 years of my life, and now I'm having to go from point A to point C. So this video kind of explains a little bit about that.
Hold the mouse all the way to the loop.
Okay.
Not so long ago, many scientists believed that the brain did not change after childhood, that it was hardwired and fixed by the time we became adults. But recent advances in only the last decade now tell us that this is simply not true. The brain can and does change throughout our lives. It is adaptable, like plastic. Hence, neuroscientists call this neuroplasticity. How does neuroplasticity work? If you think of your brain as a dynamic, connected power grid, there are billions of pathways or roads lighting up every time you think, feel, or do something. Some of these roads are well-traveled. Think of our habits, our established ways of thinking, feeling, and doing. Every time we think in a certain way, practice a particular task, or feel a specific emotion, we strengthen this road. It becomes easier for our brains to travel this pathway. Say we think about something differently, learn a new task, or choose a different emotion. We start carving out a new road. If we keep traveling that road, our brains begin to use this pathway more, and this new way of thinking, feeling, or doing becomes second nature. The old pathway gets used less and less and weakens. This process of rewiring your brain by forming new connections and weakening old ones is neuroplasticity in action. The good news is that we all have the ability to learn and change by rewiring our brain. If you have ever changed a bad habit or thought about something differently, you have carved a new pathway in your brain and experienced neuroplasticity firsthand. With repeated and directed attention towards your desired change, you can rewire your brain.
Okay, so I believe that's common to man in general, you know, neuroplasticity. I mean, the difference between, I believe, a saved person and one who is lost is a saved man has the potential to understand the spiritual significance behind it, and it's not just a, you know, scientific thing. But yeah, every human being is capable of. There's people who aren't saved, who are trapped in addictions, who actually get themselves out of it by rewiring new pathways in their brain. I like to learn about it because I will relate scripture to neuroplasticity and how our brain works. And I mean, you can be stuck in Romans 7 and relate a lot of those verses to that. And that's what this slide. I came across these verses when putting together this study, and I kind of thought to myself, it seems like there's a contradiction going on here. In Romans 7:19, Paul is saying, "For the good that I would, I do not, but the evil which I would not, that I do." And then in 2 Corinthians, he's telling them, "Well, see it that you do no evil." I believe it's just an example of faulty brain wiring sort of getting in the way. I mean, was Paul capable of committing evil? Absolutely. And I think a large portion of Romans 7 is about, you know, what happens when we do rely on the flesh. It's very easy to, you know, I mean, I feel like that a lot of times where it could be an argument with my wife, or it could be temptation to do something I don't want to do that I know is wrong that I used to do before and give into it a lot more easier. And yeah, the evil that I don't want to do, you know, I do. And then here on the flip side, Paul saying, I pray that you do no evil. But I think it's just simply a choice.
Jason, what's the verse in the black?
The verse in the black, you can't see that, can you? Okay. It's Romans 8:6. And it says, for to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. I have an arrow drawn from, but the evil which I would not, that I do, in relation to being carnally minded and death. And then an arrow from spiritually minded, which is life and peace, to now that I pray that you do no evil. I think to choose to do good is a fight. It is for me. It's a fight, especially with regards to how my brain has been wired. And, you know, everybody's different. A lot of it has to do with what we went through in our childhoods. What were we exposed to? And so forth and so forth. We do have verses like Romans 6:6 that says our old man is crucified. I mean, that's pretty much plain and simple. I mean, he's dead. He's no longer living. But yet we have some of these verses, like in Colossians, where it says, mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth. You know, so of course, we're, you know, to be carnally minded is death. Yeah, physical death. Yeah, for the wages of sin is death. But also, it's like a spiritual death. I mean, at least it is for me. When I'm carnally minded, it doesn't feel right, especially when I know that the Son of God Himself lives within inside of me. I don't know if that's a part of shame and guilt, possibly not, but I mean, death is a pretty serious term to say that to be carnally minded is death. So if I think a certain way that I know I shouldn't be thinking, and I feel shame and guilt, yeah, that feels like death. So I don't know if there's an association or a connection there or not. You know, feel free to chime in if you have any thoughts. So our old man is dead, but there's the struggle continues, and I think that's why Paul could utter in Romans 7:24, O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this body of death? He could say that when he relied on his flesh. When Paul relied on his flesh, he could say, O wretched man that I am. I mean, I have days where I say, O wretched man that I am. Like when I rely on my flesh, I feel that way. And that's sort of going against, I mean, so I don't feel that there's anything wrong because I'm sort of, at least in feeling that way, oh wretched man that I am, as long as I realize right then and there what my identity is and who Christ has made me to be. I'm complete in Him. All my sins have been forgiven, period. So how could I be wretched? Well, I am in this flesh. It is weak. I do have to battle against it on a continuous basis. Sorry about that not showing up. Shows up on my computer screen okay. So, next slide here. Yes, many of our choices can be explained through neuroplasticity. You know, I mentioned we've got old pathways and new pathways. I don't know a whole lot about scientifically how that all works, but I take a lot of people's word for it. Traveling down an old pathway could certainly be, you know, when we're following after evil, which we're commanded not to. But sorry, Paul said it, and we're capable of doing it too. And this is just plain and simple, traveling down an old pathway. Traveling down a new pathway is when Paul says, now I pray to God that you do no evil, or that when you're spiritually minded, or there's that verse in Colossians, mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth. I mean, for me, when I do that, and I seriously do that, and I'm not giving in to any temptation that comes my way, I am establishing a new pathway, because that was not my mode before. My mode before was to just follow my old ways, which was a constant, continuous struggle, falling into temptation and kind of giving into it. It's difficult to shake old behavioral patterns. This is why Paul in Romans 6:21 can say, what fruit had ye then in those things whereof ye are now ashamed? For the end of those things is death. Again, you know, I don't know if he's meaning physical death, because, yeah, the wages of sin is death, but it's like a spiritual death when we're living in them. And speaking of living in them, in Colossians 3:7, he says, in the which ye also walked sometime when you lived in them. Or Ephesians 2:2-3, wherein in time past he walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince and the power of the air. So no doubt there's a struggle. What does it mean to feel weak? And this is personal with me. We feel weak not because we travel down old pathways, but because our old pathways never go away. I learned this through reading some about neuroplasticity, is that old pathways never go away. They're there. You can diminish them over time, but they're still there. Thus, the temptation is still want to do something that you know you shouldn't be doing. So it can be a constant struggle. I believe the Son of God himself can sympathize with our struggles against sin. There's a verse that I found in Hebrews 4:15, which says, "For we have not an high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin." In other words, I kind of wrote that out. Touched with the feeling sort of means sympathize. So we do not have a high priest which cannot sympathize with our weakness, but was tempted every way that we are, just without committing any sin. Of course, he was sinless, but it says here that he was tempted. And I believe that temptations cause us to feel weak, according to this verse, because he can sympathize with our weakness, because he himself was actually tempted at all points, like we are. There's three examples that I'd like to show of Christ's temptations. The first one is in Luke 4, verses 12 through 14. Which says, "And Jesus answering said unto him, It is said, Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God." He's speaking to the devil here. "Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God." And when the devil had ended all the temptation, he departed from him for a season. And Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit into Galilee. And there went out a fame of him through all the region round about. I found here in Luke, I believe it's in that same chapter 4, verses 2, that Christ was tempted for 40 days, being 40 days tempted of the devil. That's pretty significant. That's some major temptations going on there. And then, you know, just last night I actually thought of this acronym called HOPE. You know, you can read it all over the internet. It's prevalent in like AA groups and that sort of thing, self-help groups. But HOPE just means hungry, angry, lonely, tired. And they say, you know, you're more susceptible to giving in to something if you're hungry, angry, lonely, tired. So, yes. God himself was manifested in the flesh. So, was he hungry? Yeah, he possibly could have been hungry. Not sure if he was angry. I suppose he could have been angry with all the temptation that Satan brought to him. Was he lonely? I don't know. He was by himself out there for 40 days. Was he tired? I'm sure he was extremely, extremely tired. So, Satan, Christ, is tempted. He rejects all of the temptations and then returns in the power of the Spirit. So that's one example of Christ's temptations. Another one here is Luke chapter 22, verses 42 through 44, which says, saying, "Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me." And I believe this is the Garden of Gethsemane. "Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done." And there appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him and being in an agony. And that's kind of an important word that I'll get to in a second here. But being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was as it were great drops of blood falling down to the ground. So here Christ is praying to the Father. He's tempted in a way. He wants the Father's will, or his will, however you want to think of that, to be done. But nonetheless, he's in human flesh, so he's tempted. And I know he was tempted because he had to be strengthened or given power by an angel of God. And he's in agony, which I look at this way as he has a deep awareness of this struggle, and he prays even the more. He prays even more. He has a deep awareness of this struggle. He's in agony. And so here is the weakness the Son of God experienced. And so we too don't have to sin or live in sin to feel our own weakness. He was crucified through weakness. 2 Corinthians 13:4 says, "For though he was crucified through weakness, yet he liveth by the power of God." And then Paul also says, "For we also are weak in him." And then that's sort of, that for me, it ties into 2 Corinthians 12:9. "And he said unto me, My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness." So Christ himself was crucified through weakness, and we also are weak in him. And again, as long as we're in these mortal bodies, this weakness is going to be prevalent. This word agony, this is kind of interesting. This is the first verse up there, Luke 22:44, "And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly." That word is also used in 2 Timothy 4:7. It's translated "fight" there. It's translated "fight." And the verb form of that same Greek word is translated "fought" in that verse. And then if we go to Hebrews 12:1, that same word, agon or agony, the word that's translated agony in Luke 22 is translated "race" in Hebrews 12:1, which when we think of a race, we think of endurance, something that's difficult to actually get through. And it's also used in 1 Timothy 6:12, where Paul says, "Fight the good fight of faith." Again, he's using the verb form and the noun form of that word, which is translated agony in Luke 22. And when you read the context, which you won't do here, but when you read the context in 1 Timothy 6:12, it's about fleeing these things. He's talking to Timothy, "Flee these things and follow after this." So fight the good fight of faith. So there's a practical implication to that in our lives, about fleeing something and then following after something. It has the idea of laboring. The word is also used in Colossians 4:12, translated "laboring fervently," always laboring fervently. I believe he was referring to Epaphras there. But so Darby, there's an interesting translation. Darby, he chose to use the word combat for that. And so when you look up the word "fight" or "combat" in the dictionary, in Webster's 1820 dictionary, they really carry the same meaning. "Fight" says to carry on contention, to maintain a struggle for victory over enemies, and actually lists 2 Timothy 4:7 there. In "combat," pretty much the same thing, a fighting, a struggle to resist, overthrow, or conquer, contest by force, engagement, battle, as the combat of armies. Yeah, when we think of war, we think of the word combat, and there's usually always pain of some sort, whether mental or physical, when we think of combat. And that's the race which Paul ran. That's the fight that he actually fought. I don't know why that did that, but it was kind of cool. Maybe I was playing around with it or something. Let's see here. Okay, getting towards the end here. So, of course, the good news is we are not alone in this fight. The Spirit certainly assists us. In Romans 8:26, Paul says, likewise, the Spirit also helpeth our infirmities, or helpeth our weaknesses, for we know not what we should pray for as we ought, but the Spirit itself maketh intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered. So yeah, the Spirit helps us in our weakness. Ephesians 6, Paul sort of commands the Ephesians to be strong in the Lord. Now, to be strong in the Lord doesn't mean that we're not weak. It means that we're weak. So our weakness can actually be translated into his strength. That's what he said. My strength is made perfect through your weakness. Be strong. This is a command. Paul is instructing them to be strong. In other words, we can have a choice not to be strong. At least it can be easy for me not to be strong at times. Paul also instructs them to put on. These words are both in the imperative mood, which I believe means a command. So yeah, his strength is made perfect through our weakness. Paul wanted to, this is an interesting verse, he wanted to know the power of Christ's resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being made conformable unto his death. I believe know here, when Paul says I wanted to know the power of his resurrection, is that he wanted to somehow experience it in this life. I mean, I think Paul knew that he was going to be resurrected. I think there's somewhere in there it says, if by any means I might attain unto the resurrection of the dead. Well, I've always thought about that verse because I think Paul was sure of his resurrection, but I think that he wanted to know the power of Christ's resurrection and have a part in the fellowship in Christ's sufferings, and in a way be made conformable unto his death in this life, in this walk. So what are his sufferings? What are Christ's sufferings? Because Paul does say he wanted to know the fellowship of his sufferings. I think we get a little hint at what it might mean back in Hebrews 2:17-18 says, wherefore in all things it behooved him to be made like unto his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make reconciliation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself hath suffered being tempted, he is able to succor them that are tempted. So I had to look up this word succor. Am I pronouncing that right? Succor. Succor.
Whatever you say to the teacher.
Okay. Didn't sound right, but succor sounds better. Succor. In the dictionary here, 1820 Webster's Dictionary, literally to run to or run to support, hence to help or relieve when in difficulty, want, or distress. Certainly he did that to me in my life back in February of 2018. Except he came running to me. I don't think it was me so much running to him, but nonetheless. And I think this is what, this kind of ties into what Paul says here in 1 Corinthians 10:13. It's up on the slide there. There hath no temptation taken you but such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation also make a way of escape that ye may able to bear it. So in other words, Paul is saying that the Lord will give us the ability to bear it, to get through it. And that word bear, the other two times it's used, it's translated endure or endured. So kind of ties into, you know, the word agony being translated race in Hebrews there. And Paul saying here in 1 Corinthians that we should be able to endure it or kind of get through it. So bearing a temptation or carrying the weight of it doesn't mean that we give in to it, but that we bear it. And he's the perfect example because he himself suffered being tempted like us. I kind of covered this here on this slide. Again, the fellowship of his sufferings being related to that he himself hath suffered being tempted. and that the conformable unto his death, if we're made conformable unto his death, we can be, because he himself was also crucified through weakness. And then an important aspect of this is prayer is pretty vital. I'm learning how to pray. I think prayer is an individual. It's individual to everybody. There's not an answer. This is how you should pray, sort of thing. But I took it upon myself to kind of look up each time that Paul is actually, sometimes when I'm reading through Paul's letters, I don't realize that I'm reading through a prayer of his, but it's a prayer. If you just look closely, so there's quite a bit of them. So I believe when we're aware of our weakness, at least for me, it definitely carries a conviction for wanting to need him. And I believe that my strongholds and a lot of the garbage that I was dealing with in my life came about because of my wife's prayers for me. And I do believe in that. Like I said, I didn't come running to him. He came running to me. However that all works out. But Paul says pray without ceasing. That's a command. I mean, we should do that. I was talking with Craig and Carrie last night over dinner, and pray without ceasing. I'm trying to learn to just talk to God, talk to him like he's a friend of mine. If I'm driving, or if a temptation comes into my mind, what do I do? The old me is like, okay, well, I don't need you, Lord, and I'm just going to try to deal with this myself, kind of thing. But it doesn't work so well. So, like I said, I'm in an infancy stage, learning how to crawl all over again, and I think prayer is a very, very vital aspect of feeling my weakness. In Romans 1:9, Paul says, "For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing," here's the without ceasing, "I make mention of you always in my prayers." So again, even praying for other people, how important is that? So hopefully that made some sense to you. It's kind of maybe a hodgepodge of things that I put together, but hopefully it made some sense, and appreciate your attention. So, yeah, you're welcome.
Any questions?
I'll take questions. Okay. I mean, if somebody has any questions or comments, yeah. Absolutely.
All right, well, we want to thank Jason for his lesson. This will go on the internet. I'm going to request that you send me that PowerPoint again with the changes so that I can save it as a PDF and put it on the church website, if you're okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
Next Sunday, we'll continue with the class, studying the issues related to the translation and preservation of the text. Next Sunday, I'm going to teach the second lesson on the life and times of William Tyndale. So we're looking at that translation and his life and circumstances. So I'm going to cut this off here. We're done a few minutes early. So if you want to help us clean stuff up, that'd be appreciated. But I want to thank Jason for the lesson. So I am...